So you're describing whether this system of was it open outcry? Was it?
That's right.
Was,
yes.
Was disruptive?
It didn't. It didn't happen in the overall spread of the UK equity market because there were so many stocks, several thousand, I think. But in the tighter areas, the gold market, the oil market, there was quite a lot of open bidding, and independent jobbers very often used to gamble by going in bidding aggressively for stock or offering it aggressively, that they had got their books the right way and they would either attract buyers or shake out sellers and create turnover.
Now, you say independent jobber. Was he a distinctive type?
No, I'm sorry, I meant independent operators within the jobbing firms.
I see. What was an independent operator?
Well, I mean, sort of a partner dealing in the gold share market. And or whatever.
Yes. Now, was the atmosphere quite competitive? Was there a lot of competition between jobbers?
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. Very considerable amount.
How did this show itself?
Well, the prices were very close and very tight in those days. And there was a tremendous flow of business. There were a lot of members, all belonging to individual firms, different individual firms. There were a far greater number of individual firms than there have been in the last few years. And therefore, one was competing on a wide spectrum for a considerable amount of business.
Outside the house, were you all quite amicable?
Yes, very friendly. We formed various societies, a lot of sporting societies. There were some great sporting names in the stock exchange in those days. And I think one of the attractions of the house was that you could, I think, find somebody who was interested in something in almost any degree. If you wanted Wimbledon tickets or you wanted to join the male voice choir or you wanted to know about stamps or flowers, somebody in the stock exchange was a bit of an expert in almost every particular field. And it was great to be able to go up and chat to these people. And societies and friendships did form, and I was very lucky to be involved in one. Found a member of the Stock Exchange Football Veterans Association, which kicked off in 1958, I think it was. And that was for people who thought that they played perhaps their best football, but wanted to continue playing on a slightly more social basis.
Who did you actually compete against?
Various old boys clubs and a couple of wandering clubs, a couple of universities and things like that. So as long as we went in a league and you could have a jar or two afterwards and enjoy things. And it didn't necessitate training to the nth degree every Tuesday and Thursday night. So you weren't at sort of peak fitness and it didn't really matter if you weren't.
Now, you've said something about your relations with other jobbers in the house. Can you say something about relations with brokers? Did you feel brokers had a particular attitude to jobbers generally?
Well, they thought all jobbers were rogues, naturally. But as a small firm, we had to work very hard at building our clientele. And there's no doubt that in my early days, we didn't see the cream of the business of perhaps the very blue-blooded firms. And we had to fight our way up very much on merit. And our prices had to be more competitive, larger in size. And there were some very, very long-standing attachments, quite understandably, and particularly the great firms, rather like Casnove, Hoare & Co, Rowan Pittman, Greenwell, gravitated to their old friends. And the only way we could actually get into the act was to be very competitive. But it took some doing, and I think we got there in the end.
Did brokers ever try and use you as a source of information on particular shares or how you thought the shares were going to move?
Yes, that was the general chatter of the house. You know, what do you think of Woolworths, or do you think there's any mileage in Shell? Or, yes, they sounded out your opinions, but basically jobbers being very short-term animals, I wouldn't have considered their views experts, certainly for the public. If a jobber can take a turn within a couple of minutes, that's his function. He didn't have the obligation that the brokers do to the clients. Basically, he's a principal, which is what I liked about it, he's a totally free agent to call the prices exactly what he liked, providing, of course, he justified them in reasonable size to the brokers.
Which brings me to another question. At this time, did you feel you'd made the right decision in joining a jobbing firm? Were you happy as a jobber?
Yes, I think I was very happy. When I first came into it, I hadn't the vaguest clue as to what it was about, even though my father had been a half-commissioned man. I didn't know really what the stock exchange was. I'm not sure I had any great ambitions, to be truthful with you. But it seemed to go along quite well, and I got the odd rise or two. Yes, I was very happy playing a lot of sport and having a nice life with a very good crowd. Work was very hard. And if there was a lot of business about, you were expected to stay behind, working till 10, half past 10 at night, sorting everything out. And I nearly got the bullet for refusing to work on a Saturday morning when the senior partner told me I would be in, or else. And fortunately, or unfortunately, business dropped off a little bit and there wasn't quite the necessity to come in the following Saturday morning, so I escaped ever having to do a Saturday morning.
Did you feel you had a secure living?
Yes, I think so. I suppose in those days one didn't worry quite as much, being whatever it was, middle 20s, the world was a sort of happy place, and I seemed to be progressing, and they seemed relatively pleased with me. And I survived enjoyably.
Well, we can now come to the point at which you became a partner in the firm. How did this actually come about?
Well, I was very lucky, I think, because, as I said previously, Sidney King suggested we took up steel shares. And I think there were 14 steel companies at the time. And in 1959, there was the Macmillan election of You've Never Had It So Good. And when the Conservatives were elected, I think it was October the 8th, there was an almighty steel boom the following day. Now, we went into that election with an almost flat book, which means with no positions on either side to any great degree. And fortunately, I did a very considerable amount of trade the following day and for the next few weeks. But when we came to take out the P&L of the first day's trading, mine was very, very considerably in excess of anything the partners thought I could make.
Can you explain instantly P&L?
Your profit and loss.
Right, good.
Which used to be taken out manually in those days, or certainly in our firm, it was taken out manually. And the result, I think, was extremely gratifying and surprising to the partners. By that time, incidentally, Sidney King had left us. He'd resigned in May 1959. And due to the fact that I think the firm also had a little bit of a goodish run either side of the election, the partners put into operation a cessation plan, which in effect was a means of saving tax, and these cessations were pretty frequent in those days. But what it did mean was that you had to change the partnership of the firm. In other words, the old partnership closed, hence cessation, and a new partnership was created. You could retain the same name, and to facilitate that in 1960, after they'd seen the results of 1959-60, they brought me in as a partner.
Had the number of partners increased since you'd started?
We had taken on one.
Yes.
A man by the name of George Simmons, who unfortunately died in the mid-1960s.
Mm. And what did becoming a partner involve for you, for example, in terms of your actual work?
Nothing terribly much different. I was a very, very junior partner. In fact, although one had the obligations of a partnership, one had virtually no say in the running of the firm, but the status was quite considerable. And going back to those days, even the fact that you were a member of the stock exchange was a definite status. If you went into a shop or a restaurant or anything and you hadn't got money and you wanted to sign a cheque or anything, the fact that you were basically a member of the stock exchange was pretty good news in those days. And my word is my bond, the old stock exchange motto, was accepted in a variety of institutions. Unfortunately, I think the status has declined somewhat now, but it was quite a potent factor in those days. And partnership was, yes, you were called in to chat and you didn't have to be quite so, perhaps servile was a bit strong, but you were still called the senior partners Mr. or Sir, but it was a sign of progress, obviously.
Was it still essentially the same firm that you had joined?
Pretty much apart from Sidney King, yes, who had in 1956 asked my brother and I, my brother Gerald, to go with him, or to consider going with him. He wanted to start up his own firm, and we actually didn't know quite how to go about this, because he spoke to us in confidence and said, I intend to break away. And he put some terms to us which seemed fairly exotic, and he said, well, I'll come back to you. Well, we never heard another word, and I think I was somewhat frightened to approach him and say, what's going on? And didn't, and the thing died. And 3 years later he said, I don't know what happened to you the last time when I approached you about leaving, but I am going to go in May 1959, the end of the firm's financial year. And he said, I'm putting these terms to you and your brother, and I'd very much like you to come with us. And again, we were quite embarrassed, but one of the other partners, Henry Marks, who became a good friend of mine, somehow got wind of something that was going on and obviously twigged that Sidney King was going to go and might want me to go with him because I was his number two and was supporting him in the stores and steel market. And Henry Marks got hold of Gerald and myself one Sunday morning and asked us to go around and meet the other partners and outlined the way he thought the firm would go and what our prospects were. And he said at the time, we can't make you partners at this particular moment. I think probably because they wanted to split the cessation up amongst themselves or get that out of the way, which was fair enough. But he said, if you carry on and stick with the firm, this is the way ahead. And we declined Sidney King and stuck with Smith Brothers. And they were as good as their word, and we became partners in 1960, I think it was.
Was the firm still more or less the same size as when you joined it in terms of the number of staff?
It was growing very, very slowly, very slowly. There were one or two who came along, good friends of mine who just retired, recently retired as directors, Derek Field and Bernard Brown. And they took up jobbing sectors or assistance to the partners in jobbing sectors. The firm was growing and becoming a little bit of a force. We had attracted a better class of business in the South African gold share market, particularly from some connections with the old South African gold mining houses, which were tremendously powerful and very operative in those days. Mm-hmm. And slowly, slowly, we were getting into the better class of business in the equity market.
When you say better class, how would you distinguish better class business from other sorts?
Well, we were attracting the top firms to us. I think they found they had to come to us to a certain degree because we were competing very, very strongly, and we turned over stock very, very quickly. We had to, because the firm wasn't flush with a great deal of capital, so we had to turn over our stock very, very quickly, and therefore we were able to make bids and offers on a very, very fast basis, and we tried to increase the size of those bids and offers, and eventually drew the likes of Cazenove, Hoare & Co, Pamela Gordon, to come and at least ask us prices and occasionally deal with us.
Was this a conscious policy that the firm had decided to pursue?
I think it's a natural policy in anybody that you can't stand still, otherwise you go downhill. And the partnership at that time was relatively young. I mean, coming back from the war, I suppose the senior partners of then were in their early 40s. And so they weren't old men when this began to get motoring. And again, not having any inherited wealth, any of them, they had a necessity to make some money and to attack the situation a little bit. And they allowed the younger element and encouraged the younger element to have a freer hand. And I think fortunately, a lot of the younger element had a big interest in sport, which is a big common denominator. Basically, the four partners, senior partners, had no interest in sport, and I think, apart from Archie Jessop, and I think they realised this was a handicap, so they let the younger brigade get on a little bit, make some more contacts, and things progressed a little bit from there.
Was this something that most jobbing firms were trying to do at the time?
Well, as I said before, some of them I think were a little bit selfishly motivated. It was the senior partners and nothing else. And there was quite a bit of inherited wealth in some of these firms. So they hadn't the urgency or the drive to get on and get out into the big wild world. Whereas we basically had to.
Now the capital you were using, was it primarily your own capital?
Yes.
Did you
with bank loans, there were yes. bank loans, but it was peanuts in relation to some of the capital used.
Mm. And were the banks providing you with any long-term finance?
Well, the banks were always there. We've had a tremendous relationship, mainly with Barclays, ever since the company started, I think. And that relationship continues up to this present day, and plus a considerable variety of others now because of the internationalisation of the business. But they were extremely good to us, and there were one or two, I think, dodgy moments, which I wasn't too aware, being a very junior partner, but I know from hearsay that things were a bit rocky on one or two occasions. And they had the most peculiar system in those days whereby, although you hadn't actually dealt with a broker, you could get caught on what they called the trace. So if somebody the other side of the broker let the broker down, and a broker had passed on his stock to another broker who dealt with you, you got caught up in the backlash of everything, which was very unfair in its way. But I know a couple of times the firm was in a spot of bother.
Did this endanger the firm in any radical way?
We were, I don't think, ever in danger of being closed down, but it did create obviously a very considerable amount of tension, and you know, the banks were fair but pretty tough. And it, I know the senior partners went round once or twice and had to explain the situation extremely carefully and thoroughly, and the banks did stand by.
Well, most jobbing firms making ends meet, or did you have any hammerings?
There was one small hammering of a jobbing firm, I think H.S. Witcher and Son, that I remember. I don't think I can remember hammerings of other jobbing firms. There were a few brokers hammered, and it was a ghastly feeling when that hammer used to go in the middle of everything, bang three times, the gavel banged three times, and brought the most peculiar feeling to the pit of your stomach. You knew trouble obviously was about. And you weren't always quite sure of the knock-on effects. As soon as somebody was hammered, there was a dash to ring up the office and say, you know, what have we got open with whoever it was. It was a very, very unpleasant feeling.
What was happening to the administrative side of the business at this time? For example, were you beginning to use new technology? Were you using computers?
Very, very slowly in our case. I think we didn't truly make proper progress for a considerable number of years. I think there was a slightly inherent reluctance to spend money on machinery when individuals could do it. And of course, trading was so simple in those days. Basically, what you really needed was a jobbing book and a pencil, and the sort of back office sorted things out, matched up your stock, and there weren't too many complications. Yes, dividends and rights issues and those sort of things did put pressure on the office. But from our point of view, any sort of computerisation didn't come until several years later.
Can you describe briefly your career now as a partner?
Well, it went on till 1968, I think, when we incorporated. And we went public. We were the first stock exchange firm to become a public limited company in 1973. And I was a director of the company, obviously with the change in status of the company. And we were floated at 60 pence and fortunately achieved a small premium on the first day. And after that, Tony Lewis became chairman. I think it was 1976 when Henry Marks retired. And I became deputy chairman of the company. And
yes. Now, could you tell me something about the background to those two steps, incorporation and becoming a public company? Was this something that many jobbing firms were doing?
No. We were the first, and the only other quoted one that became was eventually Ackroyd and Smithers. I think they became public company, yes, quoted company. It was from financial and tax angles, and particularly being relatively small, the added status, the solidity of being a publicly limited company, the senior partnership and directorship at that time took the view that this would enhance Smith Brothers' position and allow us to deal in considerably greater size than we had even been known previous to that.
So by this stage there was quite a conscious policy to expand the firm?
Yes.
What were the reasons for this?
Well, I think the younger element, which comprised, if you like, mainly of Tony Lewis, David Heath, my brother Gerald and myself, was perhaps nudging the partnership to get on with it and let's get out into the big wide world. I can't recall actually having had a meeting and saying this is what we want to do, but I think they knew and could feel us flexing our muscles. And I must say, going back a few years, they'd been very generous in the distribution of the percentage that we received from the firm. They had seen that they needed to encourage youngsters, and I think they'd seen the firm was motoring and everybody was benefiting to a certain degree from it, and a fair amount of that was down to the youth and enthusiasm of the younger brigade. And as the firm got a little bit bigger and we took on new people who became partners, it was just natural that it was had to spread a little bit to go on. So that's what happened.
Was it a steady process of expansion, or was there a point at which you took off, as it were?
I think probably where we mainly took off was a little bit later on, from about 1976 onwards, when Tony Lurse became chairman. And fortunately, it coincided with a tremendous burst in the equity market. This is not to decry the fact that we weren't doing quite well in the international markets. We'd taken up other stocks, we'd taken on rubber stocks and various things like that. Australian stocks we'd taken on in the late 60s, I think it was, and we were a major part of the Australian gold boom when Poseidon went from about a pound to £125 and came back a fair way as well. Very exciting times. It's only a question of how much better they opened up in the morning every day. It was £3 higher, £5 higher. That was 1970, if I recall correctly, and we'd done rather well out of that. So we had expanded the firm very considerably. And then there was a little bit of a pause, I think, in the international scene, and the equity market took off a bit, and then we made a sort of conscious policy to really attack it. And fortunately, by that time, we'd gathered a pretty strong team of fellows around who'd been with the company. They'd come up through the company, knew the ways, the thoughts, the style, the ethos, and we had a very, very good sporting team.
This was about the mid-70s?
About the mid-70s, yes.
So how would you describe the firm at the, or the company at this point? About how big were you?
In numbers, I should think we must have been about 100 strong altogether, round about that time.
And at the top, roughly how many directors?
At the top, we had about, I think it must have been about 10 directors then. Quite a lot of youngsters had come in, including Michael Marks, who's now our chief executive. He's been with the company 30 years. So you can see he started around about 1957 or something like that. And there was a terrific spirit in the company. A lot of similar interests, and we were very sociable. We did a lot of social mixing. We did see each other after hours, a lot of entertaining amongst the people, which I don't think always applied in a lot of the other jobbing firms, certainly. And then there was the great telecommunications boom of the late 70s and onwards, and that went on for several years, interspersed with the gold boom of, I think it was 1980, when the gold price rocketed to $500 and something, and by then we were the only player virtually in the gold market, so we did pretty well out of that. And as far as I'm concerned, it went on until after the telecom privatisation, up until 86-7, when I was trading. And Tony Lurse retired as the executive chairman in 1987, I think it was April 87, and became non-executive chairman. And Michael Marks and I became joint chief executives. And that lasted until I retired on a full-time basis in April of this year.
Well, I'd like to come back to it at a later point.
Rambled.
No, that's all right. I'd like to ask you, at what point did you start to take on board new technology? What point did
yes.
this begin to make a difference in the firms?
Yes, it did. I'm just trying to remember when we got into really beginning computerisation. I think it was round about the 1976-7 mark. but you're probably asking the wrong chap about computers and technology. I don't understand it, and basically it was somebody else's job to sort that angle out. I'm sorry, but
Having to move premises to adapt to?
No, we managed to take more room in Salisbury House, where we'd been installed for some time, and that worked for a fair period of time, and we managed to house the computers and the back office and in to a considerable degree in Salisbury House.
And how did you actually manage recruitment of staff? Was this something that you did assume a policy about, or was it
basically natural development? It was on an introductory basis. Mm-hmm. If any of our people knew bright youngsters, all we wanted was bright, intelligent, sharp youngsters. At one time, rather, I think, ludicrously, we prided ourselves on the fact that we hadn't got a university chap in the firm, which was quite obviously narrow and old-fashioned. Now we have a very considerable number, and we've got a program for them to bring them on and test them. I mean, the world has changed so considerably, you need different attributes. But a lot of our people started from leaving school even at 16, 17,